ways, and there are going to be two talks on ways. So in terms of the overall processing system, we're now in this location here. There's a algorithm for estimated wave that I'm going to talk about, and then Roland Romeiser will get up and talk about an enhancement to that. And basically what I'm going to talk about is the utilization of SAR to estimate waves is pretty well established in the sense of translating an image modulation in a SAR into a wave height modulation and generating wave spectral information has been done by many people for many, many years. And here is just an example of that we generate. So you get extremely nice comparisons to the ground truth, event significance, wave height, very small moving square errors. And this is a well-known approach. What we're trying to do now at ITOP is trying to extend this to the typhoon conditions, because just like in the wind world, in the wave world, almost all this work has been done on moderate wave conditions and not very high typhoon type conditions. This is an example of the eye of Megi, and just to give you a sense of what we're looking at, if we zoom in on the eye, we look like that, and then the waves that are being observed by the SAR are these very long crested patterns that you see here. And this is very deterministic in terms of what I'm trying to do, and Roland will talk about a way to enhance this after me. What I'm trying to do is see what wave information can we get out of the SAR image modulations themselves. And what I'll show you is that's going to limit us because of the nature of the way the SARs are collected for the typhoon conditions. We're only going to see the very, very long waves. We're only going to image waves with the SAR whose wavelengths are on the order of 200 meters or longer. And so that's what I'm trying to extract out. And then the next question we need to deal with is how to extend that information to range to realms of waves which the SAR itself does not see. The process is actually pretty straightforward. It has been developed over many years. We start with the image, which we get out a small chip that has some waves. The real issue in this route here is there's a lot of SAR sensor artifacts that are in the image that we need to take out before we get to a modulation of the intensity pattern that can be translated into a wave height modulation pattern. So we need to deal with that, and there's a lot of them, and we need to automate the process. So a fair amount of what we have done in ITOP is to automate this process to go from an image to a Fourier transform description of the modulations that are in the image strictly due to the waves and not due to all of the other artifacts that a SAR sensor, by the very nature of what it is, puts into the image itself. Once we have those, the then question is to translate the modulations of the image into modulations that are due to wave height. And there are standard ways to do this. And the way that we use in ITOP for this is a modulation transfer approach, which assumes a two-scale model for the waves. That's the title of my talk. The two-scale model is just one that says that the very short waves are modulated by the long waves, and the modulation comes from a tilt effect and a effect of the currents induced by the long waves as they feel on the small waves. It's a pretty standard model that's been embedded in the community in the two-scale model. So that then translates the modulation in the image into a 2D wave-height spectrum. Of course, with typhoons, we have an additional issue. In order for us to get a SAR image of the typhoon, we tend to collect them with very coarse resolution because we want to have a very wide spatial extent to see as most of the typhoon as we can. The resolution tends to be about 100 meters, which means the only waves we'll ever see in such an image are 200 meters or larger. And so what we'll see are the waves in the image that are that wavelength or larger. This is an example of our historical test set. This is the typhoon Carosa in the Pacific. And what I'm showing here is the arrows in color are where we're able to extract a wave field, a long wave field from the SAR image itself. The direction of the arrow is the dominant wavelength and direction, and the color of the arrow is the significant wave height. In general, for every single typhoon I run this on, I get an almost similar pattern, which is the red arrow here is the direction the storm is moving. I almost always get this wedge of long period waves moving generally in the direction of the storm with significant wave heights that tend to die as you get to the center of the storm and or the waves tend to go away as you get to the center of the storm. And again, that's because I'm only viewing the very long waves, and as they move into this region of the image, the wavelengths are getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, and so the star can't observe them. To date, the only thing we've looked at is a comparison of what the star is generating in models. And so one of the things that we would love to do here today, this afternoon, is we want to start looking for ITOP at actual observations of the waves. On my last slide, I'll talk about why, for what I'm doing, that's very important to look at observations as opposed to models to try to do some validation. Here's an example, again, of Helene, a 19 storm, where I compare the SAR-derived wave to the model wave. This happened to be a WAM model run. And what I'm trying to do here is, because I'm always looking at the long waves, I don't really expect a one-to-one comparison, especially near to the eye, where you can see the WAM has very, very short waves, slightly short waves, but very, very higher waves. And I don't see any of that because I'm not observing those in the SAR. What's curious to me, though, is that when I get away from the eye, it seems like the long wave pattern you are observing in the SAR does tend to match what the model is predicting is going to be there. And I have a cluster plot here of the y to the x axis is WAM significant wave height. The y is SAR significant wave height. And if I look in this region to the left, there's a pretty good correspondence between them. As I get toward the eye, of course, the long waves are less and less contributing to the significant wave height that's in the model. And so it kind of tends to fall off. So we've run this on the data sets we have today. We have two Malacca, 22 and 24. The blue is, again, the approximate direction that the storm is propagating in. And you see the same pattern I've always seen in the historical set. You get a wedge of long-scale wave that you can observe in the SAR, propagating generally in the direction of the storm. Unfortunately, for this thing, we don't have the eye, so I'm assuming there's going to be, there would have been more waves there. And then for maybe 10-17 and maybe 10-15, we get a very similar set. To date, the only thing I have for, the one thing I want to say is, although I don't have any ground truth yet, and hopefully we're going to start to collaborate with that, what I do have is some sense of the strength of the scale of the typhoon, and I want to make sure that at least these long waves in the SAR at least are tracking the strength of the storm. So as a surrogate of the storm strength, I have here on the x-axis the best tracked peak winds, and then what I have on the y is the SAR-derived max significant wave height. And the red dots are from the ITOP experiment. Here's maybe 10, 17. And I wanted to make sure that at least in general, the waves I'm seeing in the SAR, the waves observed by the SAR, should start to get higher as the typhoon gets more severe. And I seem to be, at least I passed that check. What I do have for Maggie now is I do have a model run that David Walker generated for us using SWAN. And so what I'm showing here is the long wave SAR wave responses from Maggie. This is Maggie 10-15, and the SWAN result. This the color here, the arrows are the dominant wavelength and direction. The color is significant wave height. And then I show that where the color now is peak wavelength. And again, the same thing, I'm getting a wedge. As I get toward the eye, the long waves are starting to disappear. The waves that are in the image start to disappear from the SAR, so we don't actually get some significant wave height. And you can actually see that in the model results because the peak wavelength is starting to drift away from what the SAR can observe. So based on model results, it looks like the long waves I am seeing do seem to correspond to what the models think the long waves are there. But the next step for me then would be to say, how can I now try to bring into it the components of the wave field that aren't directly observed by the SAR? Clearly there is a wave component there that's due to the local wind. That will have wavelengths that the SAR cannot resolve. And as you just heard from a number of talks, we can actually estimate what the wind speed is. And so one approach that we can do is take the SAR wind speed map and use these wind speeds and put it into some wind wave model and add a spectral component due to the local wind at that point. So if we were to do that, here's the wind field. It would essentially be a mapping of the wind field pattern right on top of the significant wave image that we see here. And to give you a sense of scale, if we use the Pearson-Moskowitz wind model, which is probably not good for the hurricanes because of the lack of fetch, these colors of wind speed would have given us those significant wave heights. If we use, for example, the John Schwab Fresh Limited model, we get things like this. So if we do this, what we'll induce in the significant wave height map is essentially an image of the wind speed map with these levels of significant wave height. we'd be combining them in like a square root of the sum of the squares type of an approach. So what is appealing about this is everywhere we're in the pink here, the wind-generated wave fields are so small that will be dominated by the long period wave that the star directly observes. But as we move toward the eye, we're going to be dominated by the local wind wave field. Our problem with this is, of course, you need to have a wind wave model to incorporate this. Which wind wave model you use is going to significantly change what significant wave heights you come out with. And I can't use model results to validate this because I'll just basically reproduce whatever wind wave model is in the model itself. And so what I'm hoping is we can take a look at some in situ observations of waves and see if we can do some incorporation of what the appropriate wind wave model would be. In the following talk, Roland Rollmeiser will present a different approach to do this. And he will show you a way that he's filling in all of these to try and generate the wave information. So I'd like to connect to wave heights ground truth to try to do that validation, and then try to see if it's useful to use the SAR all by itself to try to get both the long wavelength wave, which I think we have, and then to incorporate the shorter waves into it. And as I said, Roland will come up next. Thank you.
Yeah, Renche, Lien, and I have actually calculated wave heights from our floats. And so in Maggie, we've got the seven floats distributed both the right and left.
Excellent.
And we'd like to compare that with your work. We don't get direction, but we get significant wave height.
Excellent. Yes.
Jeff? Chris, have you thought of using altimeter significant wave heights as an intercomparison for your SAR data sets?
No, and that would be an excellent idea.
The number of matchups is going to be small, but it's another point of intercomparison.
I guess when I'm trying to look at how the high end of the spectrum connects to the large waves, this is really a continuous path that we can feel into the spectrum of the waves from the peak out to the high frequency part, let's say the wind direction. And I think maybe you get further on that blending problem if you look for a systematic pattern to have a direction of decay into the high.
Do you have an email address?
Okay. I'll also send you a paper history looking up wave for each of the different frequencies.
Right.
So
okay.
You get the really high frequencies they have traveled so far in your interactions. So,
right.
Okay. So I'm puzzled by this approach. SAR measures the big waves. That's what it does. Period. Done.
Right.
Then the question is, what other waves are there? That's not an exercise for SAR retrieval. That's an exercise for wave modeling. And it seems to me that it's just confusing the issue by using basically a crummy wave model to take big waves and make little waves out of them when you have no information about little waves at all. It just seems like you measure long waves, you don't measure sea surface temperature, so you don't report it. Things you don't measure, you don't report, and otherwise you just make it.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I assume you have a really good wind field to try to make one, but not always.
You report what you measure, then you don't make up stuff. I mean,
who's making up stuff?
Let me just quickly get back to Eric's comment. So I think we do have
product, which is the waves observed by the SAR, what their vector is.
Perfect.
Yeah. So we have that. And right. We also have the wind field from the SAR. So maybe that is where we stop for this community. I don't know whether it would be of use, perhaps, for this community to attempt to fill that in with.
Yeah, I guess it's the context is you measure certain things.
Right.
And then in the real world, that goes into some sort of model that predicts wind and waves and weather, and you're contributing certain pieces. And I don't think there's a lot of point in you trying to do the assimilation job of doing the whole world. That present what you've got. That's right.
Okay, and so the wave format we generate will be that component, so maybe we stop out there. We'll see.
Jim?
I can just make a comment or ask you a question, not necessarily Chris, but sorry, generally. Can you give us any guidance regarding stress? You can give me a perfectly good wind field, and then I can just bow it up completely when I try to stress, which is what I really want.
All right. Yes, there is a lot of work on the fact that what the SAR is responding to is really stress and not what wind speed is. And we're estimating the wind speed by assuming a relationship between stress and wind speed. So I think there has been a lot of work done to estimate stress directly from the SAR. We haven't shown that here, but I think there's a definite way to do that.
Jim, we hope with our buoys where we can make stress measurements that we can correlate with the SAR, because one of the things the SAR gets is sort of a roughness of the surface. And so with the wind and the roughness, the idea is then to get a stress.
Great.
But that's something that's ongoing, and we've been focusing on the winds and the waves first right now.
I can understand why that stress is what we push power.
All right, thank you, Chris.
Our next talk is by Roland.